This is an ABC podcast.
We'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we work and record this program, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Turrbal and Jagera people.
We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and we extend our respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. My guest on Conversations today is Cheryl Kickett-Tucker. Cheryl is an Aboriginal woman from Western Australia. She's a Whadjuk traditional owner who lives in Perth. As a kid, growing up in a big sporty family, Cheryl fell in love with basketball, with the game, the community, and the chips she'd get from Red Rooster across the road from the courts after a game. Not only did she love basketball, she was really good at it. Cheryl had dreams of making it as a professional player, but life didn't quite work out that way. She now wears many hats. She's a university professor, a community worker, and a dedicated mum to her three children. A few years ago, Cheryl saw that kids in her community in Perth were needing some direction and guidance. So she set up an after-school basketball program, which has had some amazing results. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there.
Let's start with your family. Can you tell me how you've come to have so many uncles?
Well, I'm from a family of eight. I'm the fifth born. So amongst that crew of family, my oldest brother is, his name is Jeffrey. He has seven children of his own, but he's also a foster father. And I can't remember the latest count, but I know he's probably up to about 10 or 15 kids. And I know he's adopted the first two that he originally, you know, was charged to look after with his wife, Julie. And then going down, my family, brothers and sisters have had less and less kids. I think we learnt from our mum's livelihood of having eight kids and how tough that is, and particularly in the older days, you know, even now harder with the fast pace of this world. But with my uncles and whatnot, my mum and dad both had large families as well. So streaming out from, you know, that generation are uncles and aunts and siblings and cousins, and we're all, I tell you, we're all so connected, third, fourth, fifth cousin. And, you know, when I play basketball with kids on the court, they call me Nana Cheryl. Well, and I cut that out of their head straight away as quick as I can, because I'm too young to be a Nana, and my own children don't have kids. So because that's like a great aunt in the non-Aboriginal world, but we say Nana out of respect. And I say, well, here, I'm not your Nana, I'm your coach, so call me Cheryl.
Where did your dad grow up?
Oh, my dad was born near a tree at a place called Badgerling Mission, which is not far from Beverley in the Wheatbelt area of Western Australia. So Dad was there. He was taken across to Moora. He lived in Moora up until he was about 4 years old, which is another town site. And then from there, he was taken by the authorities at the time under the Chief Protector A.O. Neville and placed in a mission down at Rollins Mission, which is near the country town site of Collie.
And what kind of life did he live there, Cheryl? What was it like on that mission?
It was really tough. There are missions that were pretty good to our people. From the stories that my dad's told me, there's a bit of good and bad in this story. I think, first of all, the missionaries, you know, disallowed Aboriginal families to integrate, talk, yarn, meet, cuddle. And my dad was the only brother at the mission, and his biological brother, and he had a number of siblings, sisters, and I think there was three or four, I can't remember exactly, but they weren't allowed to speak to each other at all.
So he had his sisters at the same mission and he wasn't allowed to talk to them?
No, not allowed to speak Aboriginal lingo, language, culture, traditions. When they asked about their parents, they were told their parents didn't want them or their parents were dead. You know, that names were all changed. My dad has two birth certificates, two sets of names. My aunties were exactly the same. So this year we celebrated my dad's birthday on the 25th of June last year for his 80th. We don't know if we're going to do it again, that he's 80 again or 81. We're still trying to work it out. So we might just do it again just for the hell of it.
It's worth having two 80s if you make it.
That's right.
So what kind of bonds did he form then with the other boys who were on that mission
right,
with him?
Right. So, yeah. So the thing is, in terms of the original question about the uncles, this is where it comes from, because even though the boys at the mission weren't biological, you know, siblings of my father, In order to create a family unit amongst themselves, they all called each other brother. So hence, Dad always says to me, this Uncle Sam, he's Uncle so-and-so, he's Uncle so-and-so. And I used to just call everyone uncle when I was a kid. Then I started working out, hang on a minute, they aren't your brothers. You only had one brother. And so where do these people come from? And then he'd say, well, they are my brothers. You know, we were a family. We had to create our own family. So out of respect for my dad and through the trauma and, you know, tribulations that those boys had in those days, there's still a few of them around. It is, you know, once all the old people pass on, that generation will be gone. But there's still another stolen generation, which they say it's the children from those people that were put in those missions originally.
What sort of work did your dad have to do on the mission?
So Dad, he talks about this orchard all the time. And there's lots of other stuff. They don't tell you everything because it is quite a troubled past. And they're not, you know, some of the old people have, I'd say a lot of them have never had any counselling or psychological sort of interference of any sort to assist them get over the trauma that they felt. But Dad used to talk specifically about the orchard. He used to say to me on a cold winter's day that they never had shoes at the mission. The missionaries' children did, but not the kids that were there, the Aboriginal kids. And they had to pick all the fruits from the orchard and bring them in. So Dad used to call it free child labour. That's how it, my dad's pretty full on, so he'll tell you how it is, and that's what he says.
Was your mum taken from her family too?
No, my mum was lucky, very lucky. So my grandfather, according to my mum's story, and my mum was a bit more open than my father, because being a researcher myself, I wanted to know their story, but they only give you snippets because it's too hard for them. But my mum's a bit more open than my dad. And Mum used to tell me that my grandfather, Lyndon Harris, he dug a hole in the ground near trees and put a 44-gallon barrel drum down those and fit the kids in that when what we call the Munarch, which is the police, would come looking for half-caste kids, right, light-skinned kids. And then he'd put dirt over the top to hide that they'd put the kids in the barrel. So that's my mum's story.
Does she remember hiding?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She remembers all of that. And that all happened not far from Morley. And the sites are sort of still there. Like, there used to be an old farmyard there. Mum used to show me all the spaces where she used to play and where they all used to look after each other.
Mm. So when your mum and dad got together and had all of you guys, whereabouts did they live? Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Lockridge. And our house is still standing there. And
that's a suburb in Perth.
Yeah, that's a suburb in Perth, yeah. But my mum and dad, not far from this studios actually, in East Perth, there's a congregation of Aboriginal housing there, then Ashfield. In actual fact, my dad's father has a street named after him in Ashfield because of the work he did in the community and working at the local fertiliser plant. So that's called Ollie Kickett Muse, which is pretty neat. But we grew up as a family in Lockridge, which is, you know, still probably considered a low socioeconomic area.
And did you grow up speaking any Aboriginal language,
no,
Cheryl?
Not really. No, just Aboriginal English, I would call, yeah, which is a form of language. There are dialects still around, but Aboriginal English with a lot of Noongar words in there. You know, I learnt from my stepfather as well, who's Aboriginal, and he's Noongar from the Noongar Nation. So there's 14 tribes within our nation. He's a southern Noongar person, and his words are a little bit different to ours. But so I learnt mixing those. I never knew which was which. We just, you know, you just speak. So no, he didn't.
So are you Noongar as well?
Yeah, I'm a Noongar. So where we're sitting today in Perth, this is what you call Whadjuk Noongar Budja, Whadjuk Noongar territory. So I'm a traditional owner of this space because I'm born and bred here. Yes.
Growing up with all those kids, Cheryl, was it a sport mad family? Were you all into sports?
Absolutely. You're never short of a team player when you've got a large family like that and everyone else is friends with us. Like, my mum used to look after so many people. We had a 5-bedroom house, 2 toilets and 2 bathrooms, and I'm sure 4 families used to live with us. You know, I know my mum would go, yep, and I looked after them all. All my brothers were really good sports people, particularly the 2 older ones in cricket. You know, they should have made it to the WA state teams, but there were never any Aboriginal people selected in WA cricket teams. So, but brothers were involved in football. My oldest sister was a talented netballer, like really fierce netball player. And then the younger ones, we all sort of followed suit.
So what sport grabbed your heart early on?
Well, I actually was really good at athletics. I never lost a race, ever. And long jump, high jump, Like, you know, I always won sports girl of the year at the local primary school and the high school. And when I got into, when we did inter-school athletics, the same thing, I never lost a race.
So how did basketball enter the picture for you?
Well, I remember we'd moved in with my stepfamily in Midland. So we moved to Midland, which is in a suburb of Perth. And my stepsister was recruiting players and just asked, you know, would you like to come play basketball? And I'd never heard of it. I went, what's that? You know, I had no idea. Well, that was it. I was hooked. Once I got on that court and all these friends and family, and I loved it.
Why? Why did you love it so much?
It was an extension of my family at home. Like, it was a family unit that ran the centres, family, teamwork, cooperation, sharing, acting a goat when you wanted to, sticking up for each other when you needed to. I really liked that about that. But I must make a big call out to the O'Donnell family, and also particularly Peter Clements, who was my first basketball coach. He's no longer with us, but they really, really looked after us. And what I mean by that, you know, yeah, you can get a team and put them on the court, but they looked after our well-being outside that court and made sure we got to training, we got to games. It was just a family atmosphere, and that's what grabbed me.
Tell me more about Peter. What was it like being driven around in Peter's car?
Peter had a white Holden Kingswood, I think it was. But Peter, unfortunately, passed away with leukaemia, and he was married to an Aboriginal lady who's also just passed away like a year ago, actually. Anyway, Peter used to come in his white car and pick up the whole basketball team. He'd go to probably two spots and we'd all be congregating at two houses. But the thing that was common for Peter was he drank, and I don't like to say this because I'm a sporty person who's supposed to be healthy, he used to drink a lot of Coca-Cola. So the back seat of the car would always be covered in Coke cans at the bottom, you know, and when we step in was crush, 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 you know. And in those days, you'd fit about 15 kids in one car. Nobody cared. Who cared? We went the back tracks, or the black tracks, as we'd say. And like, he was just a lovely man, really lovely man.
And did you have a talent straight off for the game?
Oh, I don't know. You'd have to ask my coaches that.
Oh, come on.
I think I was just crazy. Like, I just had so much energy and I was hungry. Like, if that ball was there, I knew I had to get it. And I still have that killer instinct today.
What position did you play?
When I was younger, I think they had me playing like forward or centre, which is one of the tall. I was actually quite tall. Something's happened to me now. I don't know what it is, but I was quite tall. But when I got into state teams, the state basketball league, I was actually the captain and the point guard. So I was the driver of traffic and called the plays and whatnot.
Did that come naturally to your character?
I was really shy. I was a very shy person. And when I think it was about 15, 16, that I don't know what happened. It was like a light switch or something. But I'd started playing basketball at 10. So maybe those 5 years in between built me up. And also having the support of people around you, not to knock you down, but to bring, you know, pull you up and give you the confidence and also the opportunity. So that family, that O'Donnell family that I keep talking about, they gave opportunities through my local club, which was the Midland Police and Citizens Youth Club. So when you get opportunities and you keep giving them every, you know, all so often, I guess it was building up to that. But then I was like, not shy anymore.
How much time were you spending at the PCYC basketball courts?
It was my second home. So my mum knew where I was. She always knew where I was. She knew, out of all her children, that Cheryl's down those damn courts again, you know. I would be there probably every day of the week. Sometimes I used to umpire like till 10 o'clock at night because I had to make some money to pay my fees. And then on the weekends when we had what we call district games in those days, but now they're called Wobble, the West Australian Basketball League games, your game might not start till 10 or 11 at night. Yeah, and that was a lot for a teenage girl to get up the next morning and then go to school. But they were fun days.
Were there other kids from your community playing in the level that you were playing at?
Not in the WA representation teams, like the WA state team, no. Most of the people I played with come from the western suburbs. I was, the only one from the northeast district that used to catch trains and buses to get to training, and the other people had their mummies and daddies to drive them.
How ambitious were you?
Very.
What did you want?
I just wanted to play. I was just hungry to play. I love the game. I love the sport. You know, at 14, though, I said to my mum one day, I'm going to go all the way, Mum. I had no idea what that meant. I was still trying to find that journey, you know, but I had, you know, I was setting goals, but they weren't clear goals, you know, at that age. I guess it was from listening to people saying, oh, you could do this or you could do that. But at that time in my life, the opportunities were few and far between, you know.
You were started to get picked for state teams. Mm. What was it like playing away from home? How different was the atmosphere when you
were playing? Oh, it was really hard. It was a different world. Basically, you have to shut the door on one world to be accepted in the other.
And what was different? Tell me about that.
Oh, it's just the communication, little groups that get formed with the girls, you know. You know, a lot of girls had quite a bit of cash to spend when we had trips interstate, and I wasn't like that. I had nothing, you know. I didn't have that kind of stuff, so... You know, they had the most up-to-date shoes and the up-to-date, you know, all their material things. But I had a good heart. And besides, I used to be able to flog them on the court too, and they knew it. It was just hard. It was just a whole new, you know, when another community, the values, the behaviours, perceptions are very different. And I wasn't raised like that, but I was aware of that. And I didn't like, even to this day, I don't like that side of life, you know. It doesn't fit me.
When things were rough for you when you were away, would you call home?
Yeah. And my mum would use reverse psychology on me and say, well, you might as well give up, Cheryl. She knew I wouldn't, but she'd say that to me. And that would spur me on to stay and try and deal with it as best I can, you know. And the only way I could do it was when I got on the court, you know, because I wasn't capable of talking, you know, trying to get my point across because we were so foreign to each other. That's not a bad thing. It's just that it just didn't happen in those days, you know.
Did you actually get sort of sledging from the other teams or crowds, or was it just a feeling on the outside of the kind of world they had?
Yeah, it's always a feeling. It's always a feeling. But, you get, like when I was young, I remember being called an octopus, and I was only like 10 years old. And the comment came from a mother from the other team because I was always stealing the ball off the other players, which is a good thing in basketball, but the parent didn't like it. And that stuck with me, you know. I was really upset after that. I remember going home and bawling my eyes out to my mum. Again, she'd use the reverse psychology on me, and I thought, I'll show her what an octopus can do next time. You know, that's what my mum would tell me, so that's what I did, you know.
What did she think about you concentrating so much of your energy at high school on basketball?
Yeah, Mum got a bit worried about that because she knew I was a smart kid, like, because I really love learning. Even though I'm quite qualified now, I still open myself up to be a learner, and I love learning new things, particularly new cultures, really into that, into Turkish culture at the moment. I don't know what that is, but it is, you know. But my mum said to me, you know, you can't eat a basketball. Basically what she was saying to me was, you know, basketball isn't going to give you the goods that you need to have a life and be able to feed yourself and have a house and whatnot. But she knew I was a smart person, and I really applied myself to everything that I did, like 100%. I won't do anything unless I can give 120%. I won't start it unless I can do that. So she knew that. And when I got to the end of high school, I took a year off because I was still in the National Women's Basketball League then for the Rockets, and I got a job and I saved money to get a car so I didn't have to have this O'Donnell family driving me to state training every weekend and waiting in their car for 4 hours on a Saturday and 4 hours on a Sunday for me to finish and drive me all the way back home, which was 45 minutes to an hour drive. So that's what they used to do for me.
So you actually, though, sort of put a pause on your study so that you could earn the money to buy your own car.
Yeah, because I knew I was going to go to uni. I didn't know where I was going. But I also needed a car to drive myself to this training. And training in those days were four times a week. There was individual training, weight training, team training, you name it. And I didn't want to put pressure on this family that were helping me all the time, or my mum, you know. And I couldn't be catching buses and trains because it just took forever. There were never no trains on buses on a Sunday. So that was a difficult thing in those days as well.
What kind of job did you get?
Well, actual fact, I'm a Midland girl. So I walked the streets of Midland, much to the dismay of my mum. And I said, I'm just going to walk and give my resume out and just ask if anyone needs someone to work for. I got a lot of doors slammed in my face as soon as they saw, you know, what I looked like. That was the end of that, but I didn't let that stop me. And I ended up going to the community newspaper group for the Midland Reporter in those days, and a Pakistani guy, a coloured man, thank God for him, gave me a job. You know, and he knows who he is, and I thank him very much for that, because even though he put me on reception, I ended up being one of their sports journalists for the junior sports program, which was brilliant. I loved it.
So did he manage to get the car?
I managed to get the car. I even know my registration number, XIP556, you know, Datsun 120Y, aqua blue, and it ran on the smell of an oily rag. You didn't have to put a drop in, just a smell, and that car would go. Now, you can't get a car like that these days. I wish we could.
And did you load it up with people the way that your coach had loaded his?
So I've basically done what Peter did for me. I remember playing at a place called the Alma Venville Centre, which is in Maylands in a Perth area here. We were running a part of a basketball program there, and there was a lot of boys that were boarding from up north in Western Australia, in Broome and places like that. And I'd known these boys, and they never had any money on them. You know, they all stayed in a hostel and they couldn't get home one night. And my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, said, oh, let's drive them home. I'm going, are you kidding me? It's a two-door sedan. He said, let's put the back seat down and they can all lay down. I went, okay, but we're going to have to do the black tracks, because if the coppers pick us up, we're in trouble. I hope the police aren't listening to this. Jeez. I remember feeding in, I think it was 8 kids in the back of that car, plus me and my hubby. There was 10 of us. But they were all bony, so skinny, like really skinny. So it was no problem. There was no weight to the car. There was just a lot of legs and arms in the back seat. And when we pulled the hood up at the back and everyone got out, like, we had an audience watching us.
Like a clown car.
Yeah.
Kid after kid.
That's exactly what it was like, you know. But they had to get home, so we did that for them, you know. There's no skin off our teeth.
The Cheryl Taxi Service.
There you go.
So you were giving so much of your time and your energy and your effort to basketball. Were you still loving it?
Oh, yeah. I love basketball. I didn't like it when I finished, like when I kind of retired. I never use the word retired because I'm not retired. I still play, you see. But I left the state basketball league competition. I went over to America, you see, and I did my master's degree. When I came back, that's when I stopped. Too political. I got sick of the game. Not the game on the court, the game off the court. You know, it was just too much. I needed a break from that stuff.
Was it partly that as you got, I don't know, more professional, that your style of playing had to change as well? Was any of that on the court?
Yeah, that was all along, though. Like, when I played for my club as a junior, like when I played for PCYC and Swan Districts, so I was allowed that freedom to play how I knew. But once you get into state teams, they mould you into team offences, team defences, so individual flaring moments were rare. You know, that crushed me a bit, but I knew that that was the world I was going into. I was aware of that, you know. But as I got older, I got sick of it.
Was there a part of you that was a bit heartbroken at letting go of that, you know, that professional ambition to play basketball?
It was either that or my knees were going to blow. So it was a good time for having a break and getting my knees broken professionally by a physician. And so I can have a life of not having too much knee injuries.
What did you plan to study at uni here in Australia first off?
Okay, so when I was in year 12, they took all the students from year 12 to all the universities. We had a camp. We got to visit all the universities, and one that caught my eye was Edith Cowan University, and it was called WACI in those days, which stood for West Australia College of Advanced Education. I went to see the Aboriginal Liaison Officer for Career Advising, who was an Aboriginal, and I said, look, I'm good at sport, and I really want to come to university. I can't wait for this piece of my life to start. And I think what would suit me is something in sport. And I said, I have had a look at the physical education career pathway, and I think that's the one for me. Well, she told me that, and this lady's no longer with us either. She's passed on, unfortunately, but was a nice lady though. She told me that Aboriginal people couldn't study science and chemistry and that sort of stuff.
Like she said that.
She said that to me. And I was, first of all, the shock in your face was exactly how I had that shock. She had no idea who I was. She didn't know I was a good student at university, at high school, that I was very committed. I never had a day off, you know. And that just crushed me, absolutely crushed me. I remember going home so distressed. And lo and behold, I had to call on my poor mum and go, Mum, this is what this lady told me. And I was really crushed, you know. But Mum remembered the story, and not long after that, would have been probably 5 or 6 months, she saw an advertisement in the newspaper about a new course that Edith Cowan University were running called Sports Science. And she said, why don't you have a look at this? So I then started looking into the Sports Science degree. Much more sciencey than phys ed, of course. And yes, lo and behold, I now have an Associate Diploma and a Bachelor of Sports Science, plus a Master of Science. You know, God forbid if we listen to everyone that tells us something.
So, Cheryl, when you'd begun playing basketball, you'd had this idea that maybe one day it would take you to the States. Mm. What got you there in the end?
Yeah, well, the basketball didn't get me there. I actually went on a scholarship that was an academic scholarship, and I was grateful for that, you know, because I got to complete a Master of Science at the University of Oregon, which is renowned internationally for its sports science program.
Did you play basketball at all once you got there?
I did. I couldn't help myself, you know. But the thing is, when in America with college basketball or university basketball, you have to be an undergraduate student. But I was a postgraduate student, so I wasn't allowed to play in the college team. I trained with the girls, right? But I played in what they call like a YMCA competition outside of the university system, and that was a blast, absolute blast.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski.
So, Cheryl, once you landed in Oregon to do your master's, where did you live?
Well, I started off in a co-ed three-level dormitory for international students, and the room was a box, a shoebox. So on one side of the shoebox room was my bed and my desk, and on the other side was my Guatemalan counterpart, who, thank God for me, did not turn up to study at the University of Oregon. Yay! So that means I had this whole shoebox to myself to live in. But my fiancé, we got engaged before we left, was finishing off his degree at Edith Cowan University, and he had to sell all our belongings so that he could get an airline ticket to come and be with me. Because after 5 months, you know, it all the fantasy wore off, and then I realised I miss home. I need some blood over here to keep me sane.
So what happened when he turned up? Did he move into the box with you?
No. That was plan A, was he was going to move into my Guatemalan shoebox. Second one was family housing. And third one, we was going to camp out with the Native American people because we made friends with those folk and they had a sweat lodge in the back of their house, and that was the third option. Fourth option was to hang out with the Chicano Latino families who we made friends with. I had a couple of options.
You had it. Did you two actually get married in the long run?
Yeah. Monday this week was my 25th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. That means silver. I haven't seen any of it yet.
It's still time. There's still time.
I hope it's coming soon.
Did you guys come from similar backgrounds?
Right. We're both Aboriginal. I'm a river girl and I married a desert man.
So what does that mean?
Well, it means he's a long, long, long way from home. His family and his kinship groups and his tribal people are from the northeast goldfields of Western Australia, which is about an 11-hour drive. His family and his nuclear family have settled in Kalgoorlie, WA. And so you know how I said I was a Noongar person? He is a Wangai person, and his tribal groups are Noongar-Dadawalian people, where mine is Wajak, Baladong and Yuit, but I'm a traditional owner of Wajak. So our kids are from five different nationalities amongst the Aboriginal groups of WA, but he's from a family of seven as well. He's also the fifth born, and his name is Quinton, which means the fifth born. And his grandmother didn't speak a word of English, and she used to call him Dindin. And so Dindin and Cheryl, fifth born of both these two large Aboriginal families, came together. We saw each other at the Aboriginal basketball tournaments in Geraldton, which is a country town from here. I saw him at a distance. Yep, looks all right. And that was about it, because I wasn't interested in anything, because I was very studious. I had a job. I was playing basketball and I was going to university, just starting into university. So that was like a January the 26th in 1986. The following year, 1987, I started university studies at Edith Cowan. He was doing a teaching degree. I opened the door up and we banged into each other. My lunchbox fell, the apple rolled that way, the banana was over there. He picked it up and he goes, "You're Cheryl Kickett, aren't you?" And I'm going, "Yes." And that was it.
That was it.
That's 31 years ago. That happened. That's longer than my, like, half, over half my age. Jeez.
As well as getting married and doing your master's in the States and then doing a PhD, you worked in research and community development. So how did you come to set up this after-school basketball program?
Okay. I'm a very conscientious mum, so I spaced my kids out nice and good. So my first two are 5 years apart and the second two are 10 years apart. And the last little one came about because when the first two got older, they were never home, right, on a weekend. And we're like, hang on a minute, this is unusual. We grew up with large family and kids around us, and all of a sudden there were no kids around us. Oh, it's about time we had another child. Well, 10 years passed, we had another child. That's how that came about.
That's when some families get a dog or...
Well, we had that too. We had dogs and... We still have got dogs and cats, but you need a pitter-patter of little feet, you know?
So how did that... Where did the basketball pickup program come into?
I was dedicated to my own kids, right? But in that time, as I've been dedicated and working in the research field as an academic, when I'd go home, because I live in the area where the majority of Aboriginal people in Perth live, And that's where the basketball, when I was a kid, you know, used to happen. And I always get asked, you know, can you do something? Can you coach? Can you do this? But I wasn't ready to do that because I was still raising my own children. I was very, you know, I had the strength and the heart and dedication of my mum and my father and my stepfather to raise my family right. And I did that. Once my little girl was old enough, she's very, very independent, very strong. If she wasn't, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. But because she is, I'm able then to start something else. And instead of just coaching, after years of doing research in, you know, identity, sport, with Aboriginal kids and my love of basketball, just gelled the two together and wrote a program based on evidence but also experiences and the need in the community. And it's, you know, in the last 2.5 years, we've had 400 kids come through our doors. But I do want to say, even though it started with Aboriginal kids, we, halfway through the program, the doors were open for any child that wanted to come play because we never grew up in a segregated society. You know, as a family, you know, we, mum and dad always taught us to live, you know, between two worlds. And our family, my brothers and sisters are doing really well in their lives because they're able to do that. And I think when you have segregated services and programs, I don't think it really helps that kid. It might for that space and that time that they're in that program, but they've still got to live in a majority world, you know.
What's the name of the program, Cheryl?
It's called CART, which means your head, court, which means your heart, and hoops. It's one stream of a bigger program that I developed 2 years ago called CART Court Hopes to Horizons. So Head, Heart, Hopes to Horizons. So the whole philosophy behind it is we need to keep physically fit to keep our mind and our spirit and our soul, which is your head, but you need your heart pumping to be able to handle the stresses of today. But over... You know, you need hope in everything you do, but not only hope, you need to aim for a horizon. That's why it's the actual program's name, that's like an umbrella. And then underneath it are streams of sports. And the first one we started with was basketball because that's the most popular. That's the one that you don't need a lot of equipment for, like not like ice hockey and places like that. We need piles of equipment or gridiron. And now we're branching out into a swim and survive program. We've got a soccer program starting, a netball program starting, a marathon running program with Rob DiCostella, hopefully. I've only just met him, but I'm putting his name out there, Rob, if you hear this. And also a driving program.
Why is that part of what you're doing? Why the driving program?
Because, you know, the kids we work with, a lot of them are quite poor. Whether they're Aboriginal or not, doesn't matter. We've got 16 different nationalities in the basketball program at the moment, and a lot of the kids can't afford to go to a commercial driving school that charge $65 for 1 hour. And, you know, you need at least 7 to 10 lessons, and then you need a reliable car to do the test in. A lot of our families don't have family vehicles. We also found teaching our peer ambassadors, who are young people and adults, to be coaches of our basketball program, we also found a lot of them didn't have a license either. And their grandparents didn't have licenses for various reasons. Now, you know, you need a license not just to drive a car, but you need it for ID purposes. You also, you know, it's good to have a car or a vehicle of some sort so you can get to your doctor's appointments, get to get to school for your kids' assemblies and items like that. So having a car and having a license is really important, but you don't really need a car. You need the license, because in our community, a lot of families don't have their birth certificate, and they need the birth certificate to get their license, and they need the license for ID purposes, you see. So it's really important that we do that. So the basketball coaches and the peer ambassadors, you know, who are of driving age, will be trained as driving instructors in a car, hopefully, if we get this car, to drive the community and teach them so they can have their driving license.
When it comes to the basketball that these kids are playing, Cheryl, is it competitive the way you were, or is it more about it fun?
No, it's more about fun. There are pockets of kids, don't get me wrong, who are awesome. Like, I honestly could see them on the path to American NBA and Australia NBL. And if they've got the right support at home, a lot of these kids don't have that. So that's where we step into the place and help raise funds for them. So on Tuesday, just recently, I pulled a couple of my older boys in the Raptors team that we have together to teach them a couple of drills on being an offensive threat on the court at all times. They've never had that. But these are kids who are really good at the sport. But new kids, it's always got to be fun. It has to be a safe environment. We're their family for that time. And we also provide a healthy food, particularly fruit, because a lot of them don't eat fruit, on the Tuesday before we head into the sessions.
What happens, or what can happen, with these kids at school holiday time?
Oh, school holiday's horrible for some of these kids, because their postcode is like a lock and key, because they don't have the funds. They don't have the transport means to be able to get outside their postcode and experience another world of opportunity. You know, they're not exposed to, like we were talking about this on Tuesday with the older girls team. You know, they're only 14, 13, 14, 15. They've never been down to Bunbury. They've never been to Busselton. And I said to them this week, I said, what I want you to do, because this is the founding team that we've got, and they play against all boys, and they're still in the competition. They want to do something. And I said, well, I'm not young anymore. I can't read your mind. You need to come together as a team. This is your homework for Saturday. So come Saturday, I want to see three things that you want to do. You talked about camping out in the bush. You talked about staying in a posh hotel. And you talked about doing a country trip. I want to see what you want to do. But remember, the most costly is the one that's done last, because we have to fundraise. So don't give me all your free wish list. You've got to think about how we are going to do it together. Not me, we. So you take ownership and responsibility of your trip that you want to do.
So it's about taking kids outside of what they're familiar with.
Yes.
It's part of what's happening with the program.
Yeah.
You ran a holiday camp for kids last year.
Oh, yes, we did.
Tell me how that went.
Well, that was called Camp Horizon. And we could have opened our doors up to like 300 kids, but we only had enough funding for 70 kids. So the older kids came for 3 nights, and their job was to help us format the last 2 days for the little kids who were aged from 8 to 10 years of age. So they came for the 2 nights at the end, or the 1 night at the end, I should say. And so these kids were putting leadership positions and camp director positions to be able to help us on site. So we don't give everything away for free. In all of our programs and our philosophy is to teach the kids to fish, not to give them fish. So that, you know, sometimes when you're on a welfare dependency cycle, it's easy to put your hand out but not do anything for it, you know. Or, you know, there could be disabilities or issues that stop you from working. But these kids are quite capable of using their brains and their minds and their spirit to make things happen. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't see them like that, but we do. They've got a lot of strengths and a lot of assets, and we put them to their tests. But the camp, we expose these kids to rock climbing, flying fox, a commando course. We even took them out to my friend's property to have a proper bushfire. campfire. And around that campfire, yes, we had marshmallows roasting, and some of the kids burnt them black and wouldn't eat them. And I'm like, give them to me. I like them black. I like anything charcoal. But they'd never knew how to do this. Like, they had no idea. Like, playing around with fire, and like we were saying, you mustn't touch it because those coals are actually hot. But they just didn't know. Once they either got burnt on their finger or their toe, or smoke inhalation, because that's why we kept saying there's a boundary around that fire. You got to stay away from that boundary because of these reasons. But some of these kids have to learn themselves to, you know, like they've got to feel it, feel the pain in that before they learn.
Tell me about the walk from the campfire back to where you guys were sleeping that night.
Oh, that was hilarious. Right. So we have kids. These kids that we deal with, a lot of them are kids who are quite socially isolated, or services don't work with them, and so they're kind of left to their device. Not a lot of them. There's a little core group. So they don't have, the support of family members at home for whatever reason to put down rules and regulations. So we kind of do that in a very fun way. And even though the kids aren't all Aboriginal, majority are, we use an Aboriginal moral of a story to keep them in line. So we were at my friend's property, and the walk back to the bus, it was about a 400 metre walk in pitch darkness. The role was everyone stayed behind the camp leaders, and Cheryl's the only one with the light. So if you want to know where you're going, you need to be behind Cheryl and the camp leaders. And we know that the same core group of kids will always test us. So what us camp leaders did, we got together and we said, okay, what's our plan tonight? So our plan tonight was to tell them the story about the Wurundjeri. So the Wurundjeri is a mythical creature that Aboriginal people use to keep kids in line. So particularly at night.
Well, they come and get you if you're doing the wrong thing.
Yes, basically. So, and they got little red eyes.
It's very useful.
Yes, it is. So we told them that story before we started the walk on the bus, right? And we knew there were a couple of headstrong kids who would test us. So what the camp leaders did, got together and said, let's send up some of our older boys that lay in the bushes. And when we got close, to basically scream and yell and scare them all. So as we got closer to them, when we were walking down the track, the boys jumped up and scared the living daylights out of the kids that were in front of us, which they weren't supposed to be in front of. So they learnt their lesson that night. And as we jumped on the bus, of course, the spirit in the bus was absolute calamity because everyone was either frightened or laughing, mainly laughing because we all got the boys basically, because it was only all boys that were doing this, of course, not the girls. But the funny thing was, when we went back to the campsite, we went around to turn the lights off. We found that all the boys had joined all their beds together. And my camp director, bless his soul, his name's Tom Zani Dan. He's from Aboriginal groups up in Broome and Derby. He told them that a yarn that he knows from up north, which is different to mine, with the same moral. And his story was about his little creature, which I can't remember the name of it. He actually likes big toes. So if you don't tuck your toes under with your blankets and your sheets, this little critter's going to grab you when you're in your bed asleep with your toe hanging out. And so when we went around to check on the kids, we took photographs of all these boys, all their beds all stuck together, three boys in one bed. You had an Aboriginal, you had an African kid, and you had a Chinese kid. They're only young kids, they're only 10 years old, all in one bed, but all like 10 beds all joined together and everything was tucked under. We go into the girls' room, and the girls had a dormitory upstairs, and they dragged all their mattresses downstairs into the common room, pushed all their mattresses together, and all slept together in the common room with all their toes tucked under as well. I'll tell you, it was the most hilarious.
Worked.
It did work. We had a good sleep that night, that's for sure.
Terrified, excited kids. That's fantastic. Cheryl, you were named Western Australia's local hero in this year's Australian Day Honours. How comfortable were you being named a local hero? You're rolling your eyes right now.
I think they should have named that community person or something, because the word hero in my community has got like negative connotations.
What do you mean?
Well, we use that word, we banter that word around when we're trying to teach a person a lesson, like don't be a hero. You know, it's in a negative connotation. So it's been hard for me to wear that in my own community, you know. But in the non-Aboriginal community, it's a word that they love, you know, war veterans and heroes and, you know, people saving people's lives. It's got a different meaning in our community and it's not seen in the same light.
So did you get, you know, did you get a bit of pushback for being called
that? Oh, yeah, a little
bit
of flack, yeah. Yeah, but I tell you, what did my mum say? If it doesn't break you, it makes you stronger. So I kind of kept saying that to myself, doesn't break you, it makes you stronger. But the thing was, I never let that... and there wasn't a lot of it. It was just enough to stir me up a little bit. But it's a way to keep me humble too, you know. So I use it in that regard. But I really use that award to highlight the work that we're doing in the community. That's the most important thing. It's not about me. It's about what we're doing in the community for these kids who really need our help. And the families that also come along that we also support at Hockley in their challenge for getting through life, you know, and giving them some hope and inspiration.
You went over to Canberra as part of this award to meet the Prime Minister. Did you bring any of your kids with you?
I wanted to bring them all, but I couldn't afford it.
So who got the lucky ticket?
Oh, my baby, of course. I don't travel anywhere. And it's hard for me because I don't travel anywhere without my family. It's just how I am, you know. So that was... Yeah, that was tough not bringing the older two, but they understood. They're good kids. So I took my 8-year-old across and my hubby, and my daughter Kara said to me, "Oh, Mum, do we have to wear dresses?" And I went, "Oh, unfortunately, yes." And we're both not dressy people. Like, I'm a shorts, jeans, tracksuit, pants kind of wearing kind of gal. And my daughter's exactly like me. We're very sporty kind of casual people, you know. And so we had to buy dresses and skirts, and I had to wear high heel shoes, which caused me a knee problem, which I'm suffering with today. And she came with me, and it was really hot over there.
And what happened when she was introduced to Scott Morrison?
Well, I was a bit nervy about meeting Scott Morrison because you know, policies and stuff, and being in the Aboriginal space, and it's a tough space to be in. Because I had so much problem with my feet wearing high heel shoes, if 3-4 hours in a row, my feet swelled up. So I ended up wearing a pair of sandals that were Crocs, and I had my high heels in my bag, but because I was knackered by the time we met the Prime Minister, we went to the lodge to have morning tea with him. I forgot to put my heels on. So even though I got this beautiful dress that I brought, this beautiful corporate dress that I thought I looked solid in, which means really good in, if you look down at my feet, you'll see my brown Croc sandals on. And then that's before, like, when you were lining up to meet him. And then afterwards, when we had a photo with him, you'll see my heels on, because I went to the bushes and changed my shoes with the security guards watching. What the hell is that black woman doing at the lodge?
Rifling through a handbag. What's she doing?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I was really, that was funny. But what happened was my 8-year-old beat me to the pump, which was awesome. So what happened was we were lining up to meet the Prime Minister and his wife. Very nice people, though. Very nice. I did like them. And he was really nice in how he addressed my daughter, but he made two fatal mistakes, which shows me he hasn't met Aboriginal young people very much, particularly young kids. He asked my daughter and what her name was, and she said, "Karis." Now, that's really clear to hear, isn't it? Karis. So he extends his hand to shake her hand and say, "Hello, Paris." And she knows what Paris is because that's my favourite city in all the world, other than Perth, of course. But Paris is my favourite place. My daughter is named after Paris with the C, Karis. And she puts one hand on her hip and she puts a finger up and said, "Excuse me, my name is Karis." And his wife was standing behind and she said, "Excuse me, Scott, I think she said Taris with a T." My daughter sticks her hand up on her other hip and she goes, "No, we're both wrong. It's Karis with a C." Well, the media were right behind us, nearly fallen over backwards. And I'm standing there going, "You go for it, daughter. Good on ya." So it took all the height away from me. But the next fatal mistake that he made was, once he figured out how to say a name, which was nice of him, he then asked, "And how old are you?" Now, my 8-year-old looks like a 12-year-old. She's really tall and she's a big girl, right? And that was the next fatal mistake. And she said, "Well, how about you guess?" This is what she said to the Prime Minister of Australia, mind you, at the lodge where he lives on his turf, not her country, if you know what I mean. And he starts at 11. Poor bugger. He started 11 and she goes, "Nope. 10. No. Nine?
No.
And meanwhile, everyone's waiting for this kid to hurry up, you know, and he finally gets to eight and she goes, yes, that's correct. That's it. I'm eight.
You're dismissed.
It was like that too. She's amazing. She just did the right thing and it was good because all I had to do was shake his hand and say hello and then walk in. That was brilliant with my Crocs on because I wanted to get away from that media real quick when I realised I had the wrong shoes on.
So is she following in your footsteps, you
reckon?
I don't
know. I think it's the other way around. My daughter last year won the citizenship at her school. And I asked the principal what the citizenship award was for and she said it was the value of humanity and caring for people in her cohort at school. And it was voted by the teachers and the peers. So that was really good. And I thought, oh, yeah, chip off the old block there, kiddo.
Does she play basketball
too?
Yes,
she does. Yes, she does.
What future do you see for her?
She's only eight, so she plays for fun. And that's all that she needs to play for now. Maybe later on when she's like probably 12, she might head down a different area, more of a developmental path rather than just, for her, it's just fun, sport, participation. That's all it is. And that's good.
Cheryl, she is a credit to you. I think you're a woman with so much going on in your life. I'm so grateful that you took the time to come and speak to us at Conversations. It's been great meeting you.
Thank you very much.
Been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.